particular welcome to Roberta Unger, who will speak on the future of the left and its economic policy as part of the Miliband program. Some of you may have been here at previous events this term, the debate I had with Martin Wolf last term. Of course, we had an associate of Professor Unger in the form of Danny Roderick. Roberta Unger is Professor of Law at Harvard University. He was born and educated in Brazil and at Harvard Law School. He has published many, many books. I shall just mention a few in English. Knowledge and Politics, Law and Modern Society, Passion, an Essay on Personality, Politics, a Work in Constructive Social Theory, his magnum opus in many ways in three volumes, Democracy Realized, The Progressive Alternative, and The Future of American Progressivism with Cornel West. Robert Unger has been active in Brazilian and Latin American politics as a candidate, as a political activist, and an advisor to many leaders, both in Brazil and outside of Brazil. He once described the progressive mission as the task of becoming, quote, original spirits who shall be able to give ourselves more fully to others because we are no longer hapless creatures of class and culture. Nota bene, all those in the cartoon stripes. He is himself unquestionably an original spirit. If you engage with his work and think about your work, you are not reading the work of you're familiar with before. He takes us to new terrains, and I'm sure he will do so this evening. He's not always easy to understand, but he's always easy to enjoy and to engage with. He once said that he was afraid of accommodation and stability, and he believed in the idea that confusion and complexity were the best forms of achieving creativity. I'm not sure that'll wash if you're my students to produce essays that are confused and complex, but confusion and complexity is the driving force. Putting oneself in unusual positions, in unusual places, in unusual theoretical frameworks is a driving force for creativity. This evening's lecture will no doubt illustrate many of these characteristics and will no doubt be creative. If you haven't heard him lecture before, you have a treat in store. So please join me in giving him a very warm welcome.
Hope. A faltering of hope is our greatest problem, political and economic, as well as moral and spiritual, in the world today. To take hope as the indispensable ally of insight was a principle governing Ralph Miliband's life and work. He may well have disapproved of much of my argument tonight. Nevertheless, I would like to think that the heartfelt words I shall speak this evening are faithful to this spirit. The future of the left is the future of two ideas. The first idea is the idea of democracy, the construction of a form of social life in which our relations to one another will no longer remain hostage to an entrenched scheme of social division and hierarchy. Social life will be freed, and we therefore will be freed in our creative and constructive powers. For a form of cooperation that is hospitable to the permanent creation of the new. The second idea is the idea that everyone, the great masses of ordinary men and women, can become a real person, discovering infinities within and engaged in the work of self-construction. these two ideas rest on the same assumption. The assumption is that the social and cultural worlds that we build and inhabit are finite with respect to us, and that we are infinite with respect to them. There is always more in us collectively, and in each of us as an individual, than there can ever be in them. These twin ideas, grounded on this assumption, have set the world on fire. Nevertheless, today, the trajectory animated by these ideas has lost its way. We do not know how to carry this cause forward. My central thesis this evening is that there is an alternative by which we can prosecute this great campaign of liberation, but that the advancement of this campaign requires us to reshape not only our institutions and our practices, but our forms of action, of consciousness, and of feeling. I develop my argument in four steps. First, I define an orienting conception of the left and contrast it to another still dominant view. Second, I suggest that this conception must seek translation into reality by testing itself against the pressure of two great contemporary problems. Third, I briefly outline four sets of innovations in our institutional arrangements and institutional ideas that together would exemplify the direction I defend. And fourth, I speak to a fundamental obstacle to the advancement of this program. So first, the conception. I propose that we think of the task of the left as defined today by the combination of an ideal with a method. The ideal is the ideal of the enhancement of human powers, of the intensification of human experience, of the broadening of our sights, of the strengthening of our ability to find light in the shadowy world of the commonplace, and to lead each of us a bigger life. This ideal has two main aspects. One aspect is the hope that we can connect with others in our practical and passionate experience without paying for this connection the price of self-suppression. The other aspect is the hope that we can engage in a particular social and cultural world wholeheartedly and even single-mindedly, without surrendering to that world our powers of criticism, resistance, and transcendence. The method that accompanies this ideal in the large transformative work of the left is the method of experimentation. Piecemeal, but motivated, sustained, and cumulative with the institutions that define the practical structure of social life. Today, after the exhaustion of the calamitous ideological adventures of the 20th century, we find established in the world a very restricted repertory of institutional arrangements available for the organization of different domains of social life. This repertory is the fate of the contemporary societies. Our interests and our ideals are nailed to the cross of these practical arrangements. To escape this fate is necessarily to enlarge this restricted institutional repertory. Now, the language in which I have described the ideal and the method is philosophical or even theological. But the political commitment that this description expresses is very straightforward. It is the idea that whatever force most credibly associates itself in the future with the creation of the new, with energy, with vitality, will in the end command the day, whether it be the left or the right. And it matters to humanity that the force that represents this ideal and this method be the one that is committed to the universal empowerment of humanity. Now, the conception of the left that I have just described stands in contrast to another still dominant conception. This dominant conception combines a theoretical egalitarianism with a thoroughgoing institutional conservatism. I have not placed the ideal of equality at the center of this conception. It is indeed inconsistent with any entrenched inequality in which the life chances of individuals are overshadowed by the hereditary transmission of economic and educational advantage through the family. And it is incompatible as well with any exaggerated surrender of society to the hierarchy of genetic endowments that would aggravate the lottery of nature by the invidious distinctions of the social order. But it does not require a commitment to a rigid equality of circumstance. What it requires is openness in the social space, openness to reconstructive power and experiment for everyone. The dominant conception singles out equality as the commanding ideal of the left, and then paradoxically combines this egalitarian commitment with the acceptance of the established institutional arrangements as the horizon within which all present political thought and action must move. And thus the most influential theories of justice in this hopeless world are theories that in their vast abstractions place a metaphysical gloss on the homely practices of compensatory redistribution established by the social democratic settlement of the mid-20th century. In that world, the world that I denounce, the progressives appear on the historical stage as the humanizers of the inevitable. And their program is only the program of their conservative adversaries with a sugary discount. This theoretical egalitarianism, straitjacketed in its institutional conservatism, is a consolation prize to which we turn when we have given up the transformation of the world. I say, away with this consolation prize. And now I pass to the second stage of my argument, the invocation of two great practical problems against which this conception must test and develop itself. Let me call the first of these problems the problem of access to the factory of innovation. So I begin alluding to a conventional idea of the central basis of practical progress. Take Adam Smith's pin factory, organized on the basis of hierarchy and specialization. The object is to save time and to refine skills. And the background conception of economic growth, continued and radicalized in Marx, is that the central condition of sustained economic growth is the coercive extraction of a surplus over current consumption. Now I contrast this view to an opposing view. First, the view opposing Adam Smith's pin factory. Imagine a man and a machine. As soon as the man learns how to repeat an activity, he embodies the repeated activity in a formula and then embodies the formula in a machine. And his whole object is to shift the focus of his energy and attention away from the repeatable to that which he does not yet know how to repeat. In this other world, where the object is not to save time by repeating, but rather to save time by not repeating, the background is no longer the coercive extraction of a surplus. The background is the development of a family of social practices centered on the form of cooperation that is most hospitable to permanent innovation. The presuppositions of innovative cooperation, of innovation-friendly cooperation, are first, the strengthening of a set of endowments that does not depend on the possession of any particular job or place in society. Second, the subversion of all entrenched social division and hierarchy. And third, the diffusion of an experimentalist impulse throughout every domain of society and culture. Today, the commanding force of the world economy increasingly becomes a network of advanced sectors of production and of learning, the heart of which is this form of vanguardism that I have just described. And these advanced sectors are established as much in India, China, or Brazil as they are in the United States, Germany, and Japan. But the vast part of humanity, even in the rich countries, is excluded from them. Even when it is lifted above poverty. The fundamental source of inequality and exclusion becomes the limitation of access to this advanced motor of the world economy. The two devices that are now on offer in the world to diminish the unequalizing consequences of this division between vanguards and rearguards are inadequate. The politically supported diffusion of small-scale property and the promotion of compensatory redistribution by the state. The first great question that is therefore presented to the left is whether we are condemned merely to attenuate the consequences of this division, or on the contrary, able to master and to overcome it. By radically expanding the gateways of access to these advanced sectors of production and learning. Now I invoke the second of the great problems against which this conception of the left must test itself. The second problem is the problem of the dependence of change upon crisis. The great social theorists of the 19th and 20th century were mistaken to believe that the central dynamic of transformation arose from within in the contradictions of modern societies and economies. It is calamity that has been the midwife of change in the double form of war and economic collapse. What the classic social theorists supposed to be the case, that transformation is internal, is in fact the goal, that we should seek to make it internal. The basic rhythm of the modern societies has been transformation with slaughter and peace with stupefaction. And therefore, the second great problem that I invoke is that we must so reorganize our arrangements and our thinking that we loosen the dependence of transformation upon catastrophe, rendering transformation endogenous. Now I pass to the third and central stage of my argument this evening. The outline of four sets of innovations in our institutional arrangements and ideas that would advance this program. Each of these is the combination of a conception with a set of practical experiments in the institutional structure of social life. I do not see a program as a blueprint. I see it as a direction. And the definition of a series of next steps such that the relevant possible for us is the adjacent possible. How to get from there to here. A common defensive conception among progressives, including progressive social scientists today, is that the universal political and economic orthodoxy, sometimes labeled neoliberalism, should be resisted by a series of local heresies that combine elements of this orthodoxy with deviations supported by local circumstance. Now, I repudiate this position, despite its evident attractions and its appearance of modesty and realism. A universal orthodoxy can be combated only by a universalizing heresy, such as liberalism and socialism were in the 19th and 20th centuries. And I therefore offer the program defined by the combination of these four sets of innovations as a contribution to the construction of this universalizing heresy. I describe four projects: the Universal Empowerment Project, the Socially Inclusive Innovation Project, the Embodied Solidarity Project, and the High Energy Democracy Project. The Universal Empowerment Project. Everyone should be secure in a set of basic rights, assets, and capabilities that do not depend on the possession of a particular job or place. Applied to the contemporary experience of Europe, this idea would suggest a reversal of the main tendency of the Union. Now the main tendency is that regulatory policy, policy about economic life, becomes increasingly centralized, but the arrangements that define the endowments and circumstances of individual are made local. On the contrary, under the aegis of such a program, the central responsibility of the Union should be to protect the basic endowments and capabilities of its citizens, while radically intensifying the occasion for experiment with the alternative forms of economic and political life. This idea of universal empowerment must be developed in two directions simultaneously. In one direction, it must be developed in the form of the gradual generalization of a principle of social inheritance, everyone counting on a basic package of resources that he inherits from the state, either in the form of a fixed fund or of a social dividend, varying upward according to the two countervailing principles of compensation for special need or reward for special achievement. The other direction in which this principle must be developed is the universalization of a form of education, both original education and lifelong education, focused on the nurturing of a core of generic, conceptual, and practical capabilities. A form of education that is selective and intensive rather than encyclopedic, that is analytical and problematic rather than informational, that is cooperative rather than authoritarian and individualist, and that is dialectical in spirit, that is proceeding in every discipline by a contrast of opposing views rather than canonical, that is to say, proceeding by the transmission of a settled core of belief. The Universal Empowerment Project, in the circumstances of rich countries such as are the Western European societies, can take bold forms. For example, in a small Scandinavian country like Norway, sitting on a cushion of oil revenues, the state can equip and finance a large part of the young population to carry forward entrepreneurial and social activities throughout the world, functioning as a kind of public venture capitalist. And these people then, returning home from the experiences of the whole world, can transform the tenor of national life. According to the principle that no one should be condemned to live a small life just because he was born in a small country. The second project is the Socially Inclusive Innovation Project. The gateway of access to the advanced sectors of production and learning must be radically expanded, so that those vanguardist practices that attenuate the lines among specialized jobs, that soften the distinction between supervisory and executory tasks, that mix cooperation and competition in the same domains of experience, and that devote themselves to the practice of permanent innovation are generalized throughout the entire economy. In much of the economies of even the richest societies, the educational, technical, and social preconditions for these vanguardist practices are missing. Their functional equivalents must therefore be created by collective action and governmental initiative. It is impossible to accomplish this task within the limits of the two forms of government-business relationships that are now available in the world. The American model of the arm's-length regulation of business by government, and the Northeast Asian model of the formulation of centralized and unitary trade and industrial policy by a bureaucratic apparatus. Between the state and the firms, there must arise a middle level of independent, publicly established, but competitive and professionally managed funds and support centers that seek to lift up the backward sectors of the economy and to give them access to the means of these advanced innovation-friendly practices of cooperation. The direction towards which such a project goes is that we liberate the market economy from its clinging to a unique system of contract and property, and rather work to the situation in which alternative regimes of private and social property come to coexist experimentally within the same economy. One of the counterparts of this project is the subversion of the present system of intellectual property that transforms innovations into assets, and its replacement by a system of state-funded rewards for invention and innovation that opens up the space of novelty for everyone. And the other counterpart is a reorientation of the understanding and the direction of macroeconomic policy. The project that I describe is incompatible with a demand-oriented Keynesianism. It is focused on a series of progressive interventions on the supply side. But it is also incompatible with the resurgence of sound public finance doctrine, the surrender of the state to the prejudices, the whims, and the interests of the financial markets. In this view, the purpose of fiscal rectitude is not to please finance, but rather to defy it. In the interest of a cumulative reconstruction of the institutional form of the market economy. The third project is the embodied solidarity project. Now we have in the rich countries a situation in which the whole economic order is broken up into different worlds. The world of the advanced economies, the world of the declining Fordist mass production industries, and then the world of the caring economy, where people take care of one another in jobs paid for by the state. To what then is social solidarity reduced? It is reduced to the passing of checks through the mail. The checks sent by the people in the first sector and to a lesser extent in the second sector, and then passing through the state, retransmitted to the people in the third sector. This is far too thin a social cement. The social solidarity that it expresses is poisoned by humiliation and distance, and it conspires in the narrowing of sympathies and of imagination. On the contrary, the universal principle must be established that every able-bodied adult must, in the course of his life, hold a job in both the production system and in the caring economy, and participate in some part of his working life or working year in the responsibility of caring for the old, the young, and the infirm beyond the limits of the family. Direct engagement, direct responsibility, direct connection is the only sound basis on which social solidarity can rest. The counterpart to this principle of embodied solidarity, I say embodied because real bodies are involved, and not just checks, people and not things, is a reconstruction of the form of the provision of public services. So now we have in the welfare states established in the mid-20th century a kind of administrative Fordism in which the state provides, as it were, the floor in the form of standardized services for the mass. But on the contrary, in this conception, the state should directly provide only those services that are too difficult, too innovative, or too expensive for civil society to provide itself with the help of the state. The state should be engaged at the frontier of social services, not at the minimum. This conception stands in contrast to the welfare state equivalent of Fordist mass production. But it also stands in opposition to the market model of a state that simply regulates the activities of profit-driven private providers of social services. What it requires is that the state help form and equip and finance the groups of civil society that can engage in the practical construction of social solidarity, and therefore give life to what I have called the embodied solidarity project. The fourth project is the project of high energy democracy, a form of political life that does not require economic collapse and war to come to life. A form of political life in which humanity is liberated from the rhythm of sleepwalking in peace and waking up in war. To increase the energy level, because only politics with a high energy level can have a rich structural content. Such a high energy democracy must have three sets of attributes. First, it must commit itself to arrangements that heighten in a sustained and organized way the level of popular political mobilization, of popular engagement in politics. Not just, for example, by the public financing of political activity, but by extended free access to the means of mass communication in favor of the political parties and the organized social movements. Second, it must go far beyond the boundaries of traditional federalism in allowing, under certain conditions, particular sectors or particular localities to opt out of the general legal and policy regime and to invent localized countermodels to the main solution, thereby allowing society, as it progresses down a certain course, to hedge its bets and to represent to itself alternative images of its own future. And third, the combination of attributes of direct and representative democracy. The enriching of representative democracy by aspects of direct democracy through the engagement of local communities in the formulation and implementation of public policy, and the direct intervention of the electorate in great issues of national debate in the form of comprehensive programmatic plebiscites. Now, I pass to the last stage of my remarks and say something about difficulty and agency. For whom is this program? It is not simply for a defined minority of very poor people in the rich country, or even for a larger mass of desperate people in the poorer countries. It is for the broad majority of working men and women who are lifted above poverty but nevertheless excluded from the advanced sectors of production and learning. Now, this mass of ordinary men and women find solace and recourse in the combination of the residual defense of certain prerogatives of the insiders, the relatively privileged workers with relatively stable jobs, and the redistributive activity of national governments through entitlement programs, paradoxically financed by the regressive taxation of consumption. I say this traditional form of defensive leftism is a losing proposition. And I propose instead a bold change of course that would associate the left with the central dynamic of innovation and of growth, of creativity and construction. Now, there is the following paradox. The minimalist program of contemporary leftism has seemed hard to sustain in the presence of what is described as the advance of flexibility, but is in fact the universalization of insecurity. I defend against this reclusive leftism, this retreat to the last line of defense, an aggressive project of reconstruction, if you like, a maximalist program And you may well say, if we cannot even defend the minimalist program, how then can we champion the maximalist one? But I nevertheless insist, only the maximalist program has a chance of succeeding. Because the minimalist program has already condemned itself to defeat by taking its own project to be the project of its adversaries with a compensatory discount. But there is still a problem that remains. I have said that part of the objective is to loosen the dependence of change on crisis. But how could one get to such a program without the intervention of crisis? The ideas that I have proposed cannot aspire to have the concreteness, the tangibility of the present arrangement. They are tainted by a remoteness. They cannot be sustained simply by a calculus of interest, unless the calculus of interest is in turn reinforced by the prophetic intimation of a different world. Prophecy, political prophecy, reinvented, reaffirmed, translated into the language of our contemporary experience, must come to the aid of the appeal to interest. Now, what is the content of this prophecy? It can be described in many equivalent ways, but one way is to recall the central protagonist of a classic European novel, a self that struggles against its milieu, against society, against its fate, that struggles and characteristically fails, but that in this failure discovers infinities within, so that even its practical defeats are moral opportunities. This idea of life as something big, of each of us as big, is the real content of the prophecy. But in what form are we to engage in this prophetic intervention? The existing forms of political and religious life are too narrow. What is required is a transformation that, although piecemeal and even gradual in method, is nevertheless revolutionary in consequence, and that puts everything up for grabs, our forms of consciousness as well as our institutional arrangements. This combination of political and religious experience does not exist. It is not available in the world. We would have to invent it. And how could it be otherwise? The world is organized only to reproduce itself. And the role of those who would defy it and transform it is never ready to hand. In the unavoidable work, therefore, of using the available roles incongruously and transgressively, what is most important is not to forget the purpose. Nietzsche said that the forgetting of the purpose is the most common form of stupidity. The goal of the left was never only to reduce inequality and insecurity, the humanization of society. The goal of the left was always also to make ourselves more godlike, the divinization of humanity. Hope.
I don't think questions work. I'd rather just speak informally with people after.
Really?
Yeah.
We usually take 5 or 6
Okay.
Now,
Roberta Unger says questions don't usually work, and he rather speaks to a few of you informally. But we do have a way of trying to make questions work by giving the audience an opportunity to raise several issues, and then you have a chance to respond to them. So let's have an experiment. Let's assume your method is sound and experiment with this. So let's start with this practical experiment in democratic dialogue about this conception. I'd like to take five or six questions and then give you a chance to respond to some of them.
You know, the reason, let me just say, to explain myself, the reason why I'm skeptical about questions is I think in a debate like this, there must be a great deal of confusion. And the argument that's necessary is an argument that can be sustained over time, so that each of us can go back and forth many times. And I find it frustrating to be asked an isolated question or a series of isolated questions and not have that opportunity to persist. But so be it.
Well, I promise to be the agent
we'll
of persistence.
Imagine sequel.
All right. I'm sure many people here are happy to be agents of persistence. That's never been a problem here. But Richard, Senator.
Well, I don't have an argument with you, but I'd like to raise an issue with you about failure, which is that failure has another dimension than giving us a kind of moral compass beyond the practical. Failures that occur in experiment can teach us something which are, I would say, less global, which teach us modesty, which teach us social distance. It's a very important aspect of learning how to deal with failure. It's, I would say, the experience that ordinary people have of failure when it becomes positive in their lives is that it's a different kind of energy than the energy you're describing. It's something that deals more with focus, with an acceptance of self-limits, with an understanding of the distances that inevitably organize human life, than it is that something that gives people that kind of transcendent moral vision of a collectivity. And I offer this, Roberto, to you just as a comment. Once we leave the world of mechanistic policy planning, which you've attacked, what faces us are kinds of experience, including the experience of failure, which may give us more of a sense of the particularness of the lives we lead, rather than a kind of larger sense of solidarity. I'll just offer this as a comment to you about this.
So, although maybe you disagree with me, I don't disagree with you. And well, So let me say two things that are only very loosely related. A great deal of leftist, progressive, revolutionary political discourse has the character of an attempt heroically to arouse the will against overwhelming odds. And the most salient example of this dramatic narrative of the strengthening of the will, this Beethoven-like rising up of resistance, was the large historical fatalist evolutionary narratives of the 19th century. History is on our side. Now I reject that historical fatalism. I don't think history is on our side, but I don't think history is against us either. And so there's this opportunity, or even this need, for the programmatic project. I don't believe in the sufficiency or the realism of these local heresies this discourse of local adaptation in which the only universal project is the orthodoxy and the heretics are all localists. But I recognize, thinking critically about my presentation, about my argument, that it may have some of this character of the attempt to cast a spell on myself and on others by this arousal of the will. So forgive me, because I find that the odds are daunting. Now my second comment, only loosely related to that, is this. I'm in deep sympathy with what I take to be your central point. One of the objectives of this project is to make people feel and be secure in a haven of vital protected interests and capabilities, so that they can then tolerate a higher level of conflict and failure. So in that sense, the relation of this part of the project, what I call the Universal Empowerment Project, to the radicalized experimentalism I propose, is like the relation of the love that a parent gives a child to the willingness of the child to run the risks necessary for self-construction, the risks of failure. So the child feels, through the love of the parent, an unconditional acceptance, and therefore can tolerate failure. The toleration of failure is necessary. And that opens up then the space in which we can begin to confront one another, not just as placeholders in this system of division and hierarchy, but as the radical originals that we all imagine ourselves to be.
Richard, do you want to come back on that? Because there's one or two others who want to bursting.
Just, can I just make one
please
comment on this? I mean, I think part of the issue about failure is that it asks us, and the failures that all human beings experience in the course of their lives, is to think about the project of solidarity and what it means. That in a certain sense, when we know our own limits as human beings, we have a different kind of solidarity than that when we feel collectively empowered by each other. And I think that's, in my own view, I mean, if socialism is a viable project, it's got to deal with issues like solitude, insufficiency, limits. These are human experiences which in a sense, are emancipatory if we can find a social formulation for them. I don't think we're on a different path on this. But I think the experience of what it means to find oneself to be a limited person in the world is so fundamental that we as good socialists have to find a way to talk about it.
But the image of personality, Richard, that is at the core of this argument, is an image that combines the two attributes of the finite and the infinite. So we are embodied, we're fragile, we're limited, we're doomed to failure and destruction. And yet, there is always more in us than there is in the situation. We spill over, and there is this residue, the classical word to describe which was spirit. So as long as you're willing to accept this combination of finitude and transcendence as being at the heart of this vision, then we are in agreement.
Then let's try and take a few. Yes. There's a microphone coming along, and then we'll take... I would like to collect a few. We don't want our audiences to be passive. We want them to have the chance to speak now. So let me try and take a couple of comments at least. Go ahead.
Hello, Professor Unger. I very much admire your boldness. I was just wanting to ask, though, it seems that on the one hand, you talk about you're against vanguardism and you're against division of labor and you're in favor of direct engagement. And on the other hand, you advocate Republican counter-elite to go and travel somewhere and then tell people that this is a way to do it. And we've seen it in other countries. Or you you talk about people caring for people who are weaker in society. I mean, you talk about liberating the market economy, and then you talk about strengthening representative democracy. In view of what you say, that only a maximalist program has any chance of succeeding, I mean, wouldn't you say that we ought to liberate ourselves from the market economy? What do you say to people like Michael Arbers and people who say that we need to go further than this, that we need to escape vanguardism of all sorts, and it's not enough to have representative democracy, it's not enough to have people who are entrepreneurs and to favor them. Do you know what I mean? How do you
Well, this is a much larger argument, which we wouldn't be able to. You want to have a series of questions?
No, I'd like a series, just because I'd like the audience a chance to get the diversity of concerns on the table, and then we'll, go ahead. Gentlemen, there, please.
Yes, first I must congratulate the professor on his very inspiring delivery. But what concerns me most is the many issues here to be addressed which can't be done tonight. But in terms of the world crisis of what we tend to call capitalism, the left seemed to have lost its way internationally. In terms of, he mentioned intervention, the crisis, consciousness, and defiance, and hope. How does he believe that the left can re-engage internationally, and how is it they can do so?
Okay, let me take a couple at the top. Yes, please, you've been waiting.
Quick question in two parts. Firstly, how do you see the left in its current form dealing with the issue of climate change? And secondly, how would you like to see the left as you conceive it dealing with the same issue?
With which issue? Which is the second?
Climate change. Confronting climate change. Yeah, up here, please.
In your maximalist program, where do you see a limit, if there is one, to this maximalist program? I mean, where do you see a limit to avoid the dangers of an excess of a maximalist program?
Look at the cues, people. Yeah.
How do I get this to work? Is it working? Professor, I'd like to first extend an invitation to you to think a little bit about Canada. 2 years ago we spoke, and I think now the country is ready for a programmatic debate, and we're a natural laboratory for the United States and perhaps the world. Sorry, that's a bit provincial.
Thank you.
But I'm not very disgusted with the LSE. Okay, and second of all, my question is an immediate one. How do we go ahead and popularize what it is that you're telling us?
Yeah, please, come along.
Yeah, it's a very specific question. I'm curious about what is the understanding of the nature of society that makes you think that this program is doable? It seems like a very wonderful vision, but what is it that you understand society to be that makes this a possible world?
Yeah. Please, we'll take a few more, and then we'll give you a chance to ruminate on them. Down here, thank you.
Thank you for a very inspiring vision. I would like to ask you if you're familiar with the writings of Leopold Kohr of about 50 years ago, of E.S. Schumacher of 40 years ago, and today John Papworth, all of whom speak about the need to restore the human scale, the manageable scale, in our institutions. I wonder if that is a perspective that you would comment on, and allied to that is the field of social ecology through which I believe we can reshape the world. Thank you.
So before I give you a chance to just reflect on some of these observations and comments and questions, let me just add one of my own. How do you take in this bold vision of ideas and institutional forms and translate it into a practical vision of politics that people can grasp on an everyday basis? Because if I were to take these four institutional programs as set out here and go to the doorstep and say, even say to my teenage children, you know, I am about this, that, and the other, they would look at me with, you know, disbelief. So what you need to do, which of course you have done and you think about all the time, is that this is not new to you, of course, is how to make a link between these overarching institutional requirements for enhancing human powers and capacity and everyday practical problem solving, which is partly the way in which people rightly make up their mind whether ideas are progressive, things to join in, things to participate in, or not. And that's the relationship between ideals as abstractions and their projected institutional and policy embodiment. Yours.
Shall I speak? Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
yeah. Let me respond only in part and only obliquely. I think it would be most useful to focus on what seems to be the recurrent concern in these remarks, which is the problem of utopianism or apparent utopianism, the translation into reality of a project such as this, and focus on different aspects of this problem. First, I start from the premise that, as Montesquieu said, no wind helps he who does not know to what port he is sailing.
Absolutely.
So a common mistake that contemporary progressives make is to pretend that they have a program, but that they face overwhelming obstacles. Now, the truth is that for the most part, they are concealing, for tactical reasons, a program that they do not have. And it's no good for us to be worried about popularization and tactics if we have no clue to the direction. And my premise is that that's the problem. Before we can produce clarity for others, we have to produce clarity in our own minds. If we impose ourselves on ourselves the constraint that everything we think must be instantaneously translatable into a language that everyone can grasp and sympathize with, we can't even begin. So that's just no good. We have to start with this effort to escape the gravitational field of the current ideas. If the idea is powerful enough, if it resonates with the human and historical truth, I affirm, it will be understood. It will break through. Not immediately, but later. And we cannot telescope into the same operation the work of invention and propagation and translation into all the languages of humanity. Now, my second observation is this. This is a task of great difficulty, because it is a task in which the present forms of thought established in the high culture of the social sciences and humanities all conspire against the work I propose. The work I propose cannot be implemented with the help of the social sciences and the humanities. It can only be implemented by their subversion. So what we now find established in the whole field of social studies and the humanities is the combination of the following three tendencies. In the positive social sciences, such as economics, rationalization, the vindication of the naturalness, the necessity, and the authority of the main line of historical evolution. The secret philosophy of these social sciences is right-wing Hegelianism. In the normative political disciplines, political philosophy and legal theory, humanization. The Mandarins, placing the metaphysical gloss that justifies the compensatory sugar. And in the humanities, escapism. Consciousness embarks on a roller coaster of adventures. It enters into a labyrinth of subjectivity unconnected to the practical transformation of society. Now, the votaries of these three tendencies all represent themselves as rivals, but in truth, they are allies. In the poisonous work of disarming the transformative imagination. And so I have to see with reality that this work you command of instant popularization must pass through a stage of
of war, not just political war, but war against the ideas established in the high culture of the university systems of the rich countries, in which somehow philosophy and politics must be combined. Philosophy and politics being these two human activities that share the two essential attributes, that first, they are not about anything in particular, but about everything, and second, that they require absolute devotion, the complete mobilization of the emotions. Now, my third observation is this. If you took those programmatic ideas that I outlined in the third stage of my argument, some might say they're very modest, and others might say they're very utopian or very radical. Now, I think this is a fundamental misunderstanding about the nature of programmatic argument. If I propose something that is distant from what exists, you can say, it's very interesting, but it's utopian. And if I propose something that's close to what exists, you'll say it's feasible, but it's trivial. And every programmatic idea will be made to seem either utopian or trivial. This false programmatic dilemma, this rhetorical paralysis of the programmatic imagination rests on a bastardized conception of political realism, which is that that is real, that is close to what already exists. It is because we do not have credible ideas about transformation that we fall back on this surrogate conception of realism as proximity to the existent. And therefore, once we adopt this surrogate conception, we are immediately faced with this false dilemma that everything is either utopian or trivial. The truth is that a programmatic argument should be understood as the demarcation of a direction. And any direction worth thinking about can be mapped at points that are relatively remote from the present or relatively close to the present. I just chose, for expository purposes, an arbitrary point in between, just to make clear the direction, not too far and not too close. But to enter into such a programmatic argument, one would then have to subvert the rationalizing, humanizing, and escapist tendencies of the present forms of thought. One would have to reject the idea that the heresies should be understood as local heresies. One would have to construct a discourse of insight and transformation free from the incubus of historical fatalism, but also deaf to the seductions of an exaggerated heroic assertion.
Round three. Yes, lots more people, I think. No? Up, please.
This plausible world sounds to my ears very, very frenetic, full of activities, people changing jobs from one place to the other, always confronting each other in a cooperative but also creative way, innovating things. I just get too tired. I feel there's no room for laziness, so to speak, but more seriously, to become stable, to settle down, to live the life contemplating things as a monk, or rather just not changing jobs ever and doing what one wants to do. That's also a very natural thing for humans to desire.
Yes. Could I speak to that.
We can be flexible and experiment.
Good. So let me say two things. One in the realm of political thought, and the other of a more general philosophical character. So a great deal of the history of modern political thought is organized on this oscillation between an anti-heroic liberal discourse, in which we think of the individuals as limited interest-bearing agents, and a heroic classical Republican discourse of politics as war, as mobilization, as constant activity. I realize that my language may be fatally tainted by the the heroic vocabulary, but my intention is not. My intention is to reject the choice between the heroic and the anti-heroic. I do not imagine replacing the finite, tired, interest-bearing individual who wants to secede from the larger world into a microcosm by this heroic myth of the selfless warrior. It's not my intention. What I imagine instead is that the ordinary activity that goes on in life and in politics, in which we make moves within a framework that we take for granted, gradually expands and sucks into itself the practice of fragmentary transformation of pieces of the framework. So we don't have the situation in which we move like automatons within the framework, except when there's a calamity and then the framework breaks down. We rather have the situation in which transformation is rendered banal. And the distance between the ordinary context-preserving and the extraordinary context-transforming moves is diminished. That's the image I have in mind, the splitting of the difference between the heroic and the anti-heroic. Now, why? And here we come to the larger philosophical conception. Because I'm starting from this idea that's related to the problem of the finite and the infinite that Richard Sennett and I were discussing a moment ago. We all of us, as you say, we tire. So we get older. We make compromises. A mummy begins to form around us. And we die many slow deaths. Now, I don't want that. I want us to die only once. And it's therefore necessary for life to be so arranged that we're able from within to break this mummy apart, to be alive while we're alive until we die, and therefore available also to one another, not just as these robots of the social scheme of division and hierarchy, but as real people. That's the larger objective, to be real, to be alive. So we don't live that we may become more godlike. On the contrary, we become more godlike that we may live.
I totally agree with you when you say that it's important to make sure we have like clear goals in mind. I also understand quite clearly what the goals of Adam Smith were, you know, when referring to the work of the pin factory worker, and Adam's and Karl Marx's goals were as well. I would like you to give us a depiction, a clear one, of what the pin factory worker would be doing in the world you envisage, like in day to day. I'm sure he would not be only providing his employer with innovative ideas about how to be more productive. I think it would be something else you have in mind, but could you give us more, like a clear idea of what you have in mind on the workplace?
Just take a couple. Your mic's not on, I think.
I probably imbibe too deeply on the kind of very English spirit of empiricism rather than the kind of high-flown rhetoric, which is very inspiring. Firstly, a lot of people have ask a similar question, but Oscar Wilde is often quoted as saying the problem with socialism that it would take too many evenings. I think you've already dealt with that, but I thought that it was too fine a quotation to leave this evening. My second issue is that you seem to have sort of, in the vision you've set out, I think you seem to sort of prevaricate between two very different things, which is an idea of sort of libertarianism and individual fulfillment, which I think perhaps is sort of best summed up in the third section, the utopian section of Robert Nozick's Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and also a kind of practical vision, which I'd say we should all become more like Sweden. Now, I think you kind of go between those two views quite a lot, and I'd say that they're kind of fundamentally incompatible for quite a number of reasons. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yes. We'll take just a couple more, and then we'll Yeah.
Hiya. What is your view about free trade and fair trade? And do you propose an alternative to the so-called new economic order, which, in my opinion, tends to discriminate against the poorest countries?
I very much agree with your criticism of academia. Maybe the laughter here masks a great discomfort, and at least I am in great discomfort. But now that we have a clear direction of where academia should go, now could you please enlighten us as to how specifically would you like academia to be more socially proactive? And that relates to another issue, the issue of the elite. Usually innovation and great leaps are created by elites and not by masses. Even in the elite academia, it is very hard to find innovation. How do you suppose to overcome that gap?
Penultimately.
My previous question, really. How do you see the left as dealing with the issue of climate change?
Yeah, that... please, just go on. In a world which is anti-regulatory. Yeah, go on.
I'm very intrigued by your idea about the indomitable spirit. I think it's a very tempting idea, and I accept your attempt to engage with what doesn't exist or yet to become. My concern, however, is how this idea would square with certain specific life worlds, certain specific cultures, where the idea of struggling and failing and trying again is just not present. So is the program you propose a program that can be thought of as implemented as a top-down program? Or how does it really connect with experiences that perhaps you and I know well? You know, the world is falling apart, and you can always ask for a less frantic approach to life. Perhaps another caipirinha, perhaps another way of getting forward.
And finally, another from the chair. How do we judge between, in your view, competing programmatic positions? Or to put the question differently, what are the criteria of validity here? You speak about creating a program which one intuitively is sympathetic to, that is, institutionally releases people's capacities, their powers, their sense of spirit and their life energies and so on. Fine. But how would we recognize that? And how do we judge between competing arguments that claim to do the same thing? I remember being in a discussion many years ago, a wonderful discussion between Herbert Marcuse and Jürgen Habermas, and Marcuse simply said, you know, modern architecture corrupts the human spirit and its energy. These ghastly modern buildings and so on, they are affront to human sensibility. And Habermas said, well, Jürgen, Herbert, you know, on what basis do you say that? He said it's objective. And he said, Habermas said to Marcuse again, how do you measure objectivity in this matter? He said, more and more people are reading my books. But the serious question here, if it's a programmatic philosophy, as it were, which can have different points of institutionalization and embodiment, as you interestingly point out in many places, what are the criteria for assessing different versions of the same thing? How do you stand behind your program and say this one is the one that unleashes these energies and powers? Because in the marketplace of ideas, or just in the public forum of ideas, it competes with others.
Of course. Well, this last series of questions is simply an invitation to carry forward this debate at every level, from the most technical questions, policy, to the general, to the most general issues of philosophy. And therefore, I'm not going to answer any of these questions. And instead, I am going to use this last moment here in our meeting to ask you a question, because given that we did have this question period, despite my initial objection, I'm going to ask a question. So enter for a moment into my view, as implausible as it may seem to some of you. And so I believe that all real politics, transformative politics, is world politics. I don't believe just in national politics. I believe that the heresies that humanity needs are universalizing heresies. I believe that they have to be carried forward through a transformation, both of practical arrangements and of forms of thought throughout the world. But I don't believe, unlike Karl Marx, that history is on my side. I don't believe that there is a pre-appointed agent of transformation, a particular class. There isn't an international movement that claims to represent this class to which I can address my words. So what should I do? What is the way to carry forward this project, which is a world project? I believe in revolution, in world revolution, although it doesn't take the form that it could take in the 19th century. It must take a completely different form. So what do you recommend to me? What are your instructions? Come to Canada? No.
Well, we need your email address to resolve this. Does anybody want a final from the floor, a final retort to the question? Finally, briefly.
You started off with the word hope, but you never mentioned the absence of trust, which brings us back to small local structures in which people know one another and can trust one another and the institution at that scale. Would you like to comment on that concept?
No, clearly. It is 8 o'clock, and we need to end at 8. And so it remains for me not only to thank you for a wonderful lecture, but a very inspiring